Ladies and gentlemen, this is July 11th, 2012. This is the Board of Public Works. The comptroller is on vacation, and I asked the treasurer if she might have any opening comments, any opening words.
Good morning. I apologize for being late. Other than that, Governor, it's a pleasure to be here.
Look, let me say something at opening about the very, very difficult week that we have endured with the big heat wave and with what and with that unprecedented storm, the likes of which I've never seen in 49 years of living in the state of Maryland. What I now understand was a derecho, in essence, a very broad band of very violent, fast-moving thunderstorms that had all the punch of a hurricane, but none of the four-day warning. So it swept across our country from southern Indiana, across southern Ohio and Kentucky, and went right across our mid-Atlantic. Knocked down more trees on the western shore, certainly, than Irene did. I mean, southern Maryland was harder hit in Irene than in this storm, but the amount of damage I saw in a lot of old neighborhoods where the trees are very familiar to me, whether in Baltimore or in Rockville, the number of our citizens who are without power for extended periods of time. We have gotten through the restoration and the recovery phase. All of us need to unpack this event, and with it, putting into context the other events of Snowmageddon, as well as the other summer thunderstorms that caused so many people to go without power back in 2010, and search for a better way forward. A grid that was resilient for the weather of the 1980s and even the 1990s is not a grid that is strong enough and resilient enough to withstand the sort of violent storms that climate change and global warming is causing in our atmosphere today. And that's going to be the reality until we get more renewable power on the grid, until we implement, you know, more broadly based green building design, geo-design, and new technology comes to the fore. The fact of the matter is the storms are not going to get less violent. They will probably become more violent. And we need to take the actions necessary, given this change in our environment, given the fact that we now lose, 500 acres a year to sea level rise. Some of the scientists were telling us that the reason for the depletion of the bay grasses in the southern part of the bay is not necessarily because of the sedimentary deposition, which has been somewhat stemmed by better farming practices and better management practices. It's because of the 2.5% degree or the 2-degree rise in water temperatures in the bay that just may make some of the eel grasses and those grasses in the southern portions of the bay that those grasses will no longer have the temperature they need and the mix that they need for their particular DNA and life. So look, all of that gets a little esoteric and a little metaphysical, and I know it's a big new concept. This concept is not new, though. We need to have a more resilient grid, and the Public Service Commission is being urged by everyone in our state, every elected official, including yours truly, to look, give us the options. We're an intelligent people. We're not stupid. We know that the weather events are becoming more deadly and dangerous. All of us have had to throw out more food in the last few years than we ever had to before, so we know our grid is not becoming stronger as the events become more violent. So give us the option of the things we need to do and what investments we need to make together in order to do the combination of actions from the tree trimming, yes, to possibly supporting a greater array of in-state capacity to respond to these outages, and to doing some strategic and targeted undergrounding. Give us the options, and then together as a people, let's take the actions we need to make this grid more resilient. The amount of money that was lost in our economy, the amount of money that businesses lost, that homeowners lost, not to mention the 18 individuals who lost their lives as a direct result of the heat, very often senior citizens living in socially isolated conditions. So we are now heading into the phase when the Public Service Commission and the utilities, both BGE and Pepco, will be submitting their after-action report on this storm. And we will be unpacking that and looking for ways forward. There are no bad ideas. This is an unprecedented development in our planet's history. These storms are more violent. Our grids, therefore, need to be more resilient. I will point out a couple of little silver linings in this, and that is the coordination and the cooperation from an emergency management standpoint in our state was actually, I believe, very, very good. The timeliness of information being provided at that level. No doubt there are issues that remain in terms of customer service and whether there was any information of meaning or value shared with customers in this. I want to thank all of the first responders that you saw in some states, some of their 911 systems and their EOCs went down. Whenever we had an EOC go down or a 911 system threatened with going down or losing power, the generator kicked in. It was working. It was on. So we have made our emergency management infrastructure far more resilient in the wake of the attacks of 9/11 than they were before. Also saw that the new regulations that we have requiring generators in the nursing homes, for the most part, worked. There were some notable and very dangerous exceptions to that where they worked only to keep the lights on but not the air conditioning systems on. The Maryland Defense Force, then these are professional people that serve in your in the Maryland National Guard. Many of them are doctors or have other vocations in health. They joined together at about day 5 of the outages to actually go door-to-door in the most severely affected areas to check, to do wellness checks on neighbors there to preserve and save as many lives as possible. And finally, there were crews who came to our state, not only the in-state crews, the men and women whose job it is to go out and work long, long hours in the hot, hot sun and go up in those bucket trucks and restore all of us from our own utilities, but there were men and women who came here from Georgia, from Florida, from Texas, from Canada, and helped us to recover from this. And so I think all of us owe a debt of gratitude to those men and women, and I think we all appreciate, I know I certainly do, their hard and hot and sweaty work and difficult and dangerous work that they did to get us restored. But we're now moving into the after-action phase of this, and let's together resolve to take actions necessary to restore the grid and acknowledge that we cannot have it both ways, that as our parents and grandparents invested in modernizing their infrastructure for their time, so too must we. And the added rub in this is that because of our reliance and the exponential increase of fossil fuels, we have the added variable of much more violent weather than what our parents and grandparents generally faced. You look at the dust bowls and the things that happened in the soil conservation back around Depression times. We made different choices. We understood that we needed to make some man-made lakes across that dust bowl, and we needed to apply better science for soil conservation. So, hey, we are not going to be the slaves of circumstance. We're not going to be victims. We're going to respond to this adversity, and we're going to have the honest conversations that a public service commission is expected to facilitate and then to act upon. So with that,
Governor, let me just add, as I come from one of those typical neighborhoods where the lights were out and the heat was on until Tuesday. And we went through it in Snowmageddon and every place else, Mohican Hills, Maryland, seems Echo, Maryland seems to get it. And I do want to thank all those folks, both from Pepco and from the county and from out of the state, who were there working as hard as they can, the individual men and women who were out there working very hard, because we saw them because we were there. They were working on the streets and on the trees constantly. And it was after the fact And I'm not sure that chopping down all of the trees is going to be the answer, because you're going to want that green cover. But beyond that, and beyond today's issue, I would also urge, Governor, I know within your administration you have started, but I think we have to do it more broadly as a model. In all of our programs, in all of our procurements and all of our building and planning programs, whether it's in the natural resources, open space procurements, or any of the other buildings, to explicitly do that with an understanding of the increasing volatility of the weather and impact of climate change. You know, I'm closely related to a climate change investigator myself, and the stories that we see and the pictures that we see, particularly for those of us along the East Coast, are very concerning, and we can't continue to do all the things that we do, the building, where we do, the way we do it, without an understanding that it's going to have a serious impact. For instance, the closer we build to the bay, the more likely the increasing salinization of the clean water aquifer is going to be enhanced. 13 islands, as you pointed out before, have already gone under in the bay. As things get more variable, the storm surges will. People look at the protracted long-term average sea level rise, but they don't look at the questions of the storm surges and what sort of harm they can do. And I think it just got to be worked explicitly into both public and as a model for private planning almost all of what we do in the coming years. So I just thank you for taking the start and pointing it out, and thank all the fine people who put the air conditioning back on for us.
Resiliency. Mm-hmm. There was some. I serve on the Homeland Security Advisory Council, and they put together a report just about 2 years ago talking about all those things that you were just talking about, Madam Treasurer.
Well,
the importance of incorporating into all public and private design the need for greater resiliency.
And I think you have to do it. You have to do it in a public way so that people understand and they begin to start doing it themselves and incorporate it into their own planning. That way the thinking gets, it doesn't seem a foreign thing anymore.
Right. We go to the Secretary's agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer. We have 15 items on the Secretary's agenda this morning.
We would note that on item number 12, grant from the African American Heritage Preservation Program to the Kennard Alumni Association. We did receive a strong letter in support from Delegate Hershey, who had to be out of state today. I'd just like to enter that into the into the record if I could. Governor, there are a few people who would like to speak on that project.
Okay, come forward.
It's a very interesting
Ms. Ann Raines is here, and I think she actually has four grants on her item, which is item 12 today, and I think she has people from each place, including Kennard, which is D on item, but maybe you'd like to tell us a little bit about.
Good morning. I won't take up very many minutes here myself, but I will introduce the first of the four projects that are being approved here today, and that is Project Rehabilitate the Two Sisters Houses in Baltimore. These are two early frame workers' houses that are documented to have housed African-American workers. And I'll introduce Ellen Von Karian, who's the Executive Director of the Society for the Preservation of Federal Hill and Fells Point.
This is the Two Sisters House in Wolf Street, Baltimore.
Good morning, everyone. I am Ellen Von Karian from the Preservation Society in Fells Point. I wish to thank the state of Maryland. I wish to thank the Maryland Historical Trust and the commission most sincerely. These properties were actually built by Anne Von Fell in Fells Point. They were the homes of African-American Caulkers. Caulkers were central figures in the shipbuilding. Frederick Douglass was a Caulker. These houses give us the opportunity really to deal with African-American heritage in Fells Point and in a way that none of the other properties that we have there do. So I just want to be brief and express my most sincere appreciation and to also thank the state and also to ensure you that we are also deeply committed to doing whatever we can do in the field of historic preservation to incorporate these same kinds of elements that you've so eloquently discussed this morning, because we really must all work together to do that. So thank you.
And what 100 block is this?
It's 612, 614 South Wolf Street, the 600 block. It's just about three blocks from the
right actual. On Wolf Street. Not, these are not alley homes.
No, they're not alley homes. They are right directly on Wolf Street. There were once hundreds of them at Fells Point. They're the sole survivors of their kind right now.
Wow. So they were all replaced with brick, huh?
They were city
most
ordinance.
Most of them burned down eventually?
Or just, as you can see, that one's pretty endangered, or just fell down. There's a half house about four up that still survives. But this was once the predominant housing stock for the laborers. And
it looks like a lot of what you still see in... I mean, it's not unlike Annapolis, huh?
Yes. Could look like it, yes. And it will be looking much better the next time you all come to Fells Point, I assure you.
I'm sure I've been by this a million times, and I never knew those homes were there.
Yes.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we know, do you have any history on these homes?
Yeah.
Knowing they were, I mean, we sort are you fairly sure that they were African American?
We know for a
homes?
Fact because we've cross-referenced with the Baltimore City Directory. So we know the exact dates, and we know the names of
Who lived there.
Of the persons who lived there. Yes.
There's a great book. You've read the book Freedom's Port?
Yes.
It has some terrific demographic information about where African American people lived in colonial Baltimore.
Which is a wonderful book, which
that's
we are using
book.
As reference to develop our interpretation for this as well.
So. Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
What will you develop your interpretation? What will happen to the house?
What will happen to the houses, one of them we hope to actually restore as a, or to, I should say not restore, but rehabilitate as a Caulker's house. The two sisters that had these properties actually have some furnishings from the kitchen. So we're hoping, and they're only two deep. I mean, they're only two rooms deep. The other property we are hoping will be what we call a conserved ruin, because you can walk in there and you can see where they use the oyster shell to insulate in the windowsills, you know, just a Chesapeake Bay kind of a phenomenon. But you can see evidence of all of these different periods of people living in it and different technological advances. So we also hope to add to the back what we're calling a sort of lab room. Now, we haven't gotten that through the Maryland Historical Trust Easement Committee. We're still working on the plan. But that would be a place where we could work with students to examine the building materials, the old ways and the old building trades, and where also we can use it as a lab for processing all of the amazing archaeological artifacts that show up in Fells Point all the time as well.
That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
And next I'll introduce for the Sandy Spring Oddfellows Lodge in Montgomery County, Dr. Winston Anderson, the committee chair of the Oddfellows Lodge Preservation Committee, and the vice chair, Dr. Vincent Hollis.
Good morning, His Excellency, members of the Board of Public Works. Without the generous assistance and sustenance of the Maryland Historical Trust, we might have lost one of the most important buildings built by African Americans in the southeastern corner of Montgomery County. Around the turn of the century, the descendants of slaves, members of the Oddfellows Lodge, built this building. This building lasted for 70 years, and it served as a meeting hall and a cultural center for blacks in the area, not just for Montgomery County, but also for parts of Howard and Prince George's County. It also served as a church when the Sharp Street United Methodist Church burned, and it was very important as a school, elementary school, in the segregated times in the 60s and the 50s and the 40s. Now, the building it was abandoned in 1975. It had no roof. And whatever roof was there served as a roosting place for vultures on their annual migration to the south. The roof was gone and open to the elements, and so the infrastructure was totally gone on the second and the first floors, and was occupied by rodents, including rats and muskrats and all sorts of bees and birds. The ground floor, or the crawl space, was occupied by a 50-year-old population of groundhogs. So we had to build it from the bottom up. And due to generous funds provided by the Historical Trust, we were able to build it to the point where it looks like this, as you see here. And we have some pictures here showing what it looked like in 1975, where the community placed a tarp on top just to keep it from being rotted. And, of course, at this time, the community wanted to demolish it because it was really an eyesore for all these years. And so now part of the renovation shows you the middle phase in building it, and the final phase is on the screen over there where it looks like this right now. Within the next month, we anticipate that the windows will be refurbished and will be in place, and again we will go to the next phase of renovation of this facility. We anticipate that in the years to come, this will continue to serve as an important cultural center, not just for blacks in the community, but for the entire Sandy Spring Olney area. We expect that it will be involved in the educational activities in the region, civic association meetings, and it will flourish once again in its original grandeur. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Sounds like a wonderful project.
That's great.
My county.
Thank you, Dr. Anderson. I just went with Dr. Anderson's daughter the other week to see the windows that had been restored and the new windows that had been made in a shop in Hanover, and they're going to look fantastic. Next, we have Newell Quinton, the operations officer for the John Quinton Foundation, representing the San Domingo Rosenwald School. You might notice that some of these projects were funded last year, and Newell in particular has made excellent progress over the past year, as you can see from the photographs, and he's actually just getting his air conditioning online. So.
Good morning, Governor, members of the board, and thank you for the opportunity to just briefly talk about our school. This school was built in 1919, and it served our community up until 1962 as a school. It's one of the many Rosenwald schools that served the black community, and we're very proud to be a part of the process to restore this school to the stage it was when I, as many other people, attended the school as a student. It will serve as a reference for other students in and around the northwestern part of Wicomico County. It shows that over years, people committed themselves to the value of education and they learned life skills. So we plan to use this building in partnership with Mardella Miller High School to work with youth in developing or teaching them life skills. And hopefully through it, it will continue to serve as a rich culture and education center. And we're very pleased that we're able to continue with the restoration of the school, as Ann said, and working with Ann and the Maryland Historic Trust. We're very fortunate to have replaced all the windows of the school. And it gives it a distinct distinction to see all the bays of windows that illuminated those classrooms. Really, there's 52 windows in and around the four sides of the school, for each classroom was illuminated with natural light, and it just makes the school stand out. So fortunately, as Ann said, we're currently installing the electrical system, heating and air conditioning, and this year, fortunately, thank you for your assistance, we plan to continue to work on the interior. So I appreciate your willingness to allow us to continue to restore this Rosenwald School, because it does have such a valuable place in the history of our community, and the effort to educate our youth. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question? You were a student there.
Yes, ma'am.
Did you all learn about and talk about the history of the Rosenwald schools when you were a student, or was this just an...
Yes, unfortunately, I did not. I attended school here from 1950 through 57, and I learned about the efforts of Booker T. Washington Rosenwald after finishing college and returning to the community
really?
After retirement, and learning about the demolition of so many of these schools, and I learned about the effort from the National Trust in preservation of the schools, and then the value that these schools provided to the African-American community, which really got me excited. So as a student, no, I did not know of the Rosenwald School. But I did, I really, when trying to do the research on the building, I was really encouraged by the efforts made by our great-grandparents in that generation to apply with the Rosenwald Fund to get money to build this school. And in 1919, this school cost approximately, I think, $5,000, and about 500 of those dollars came from the Rosenwald Fund. But the significance of that was the perseverance of those people, our ancestors, who saw it fit to build such a great institution to educate their children. And I should say also, and I was encouraged by looking at the research because that would be the area of my great-grandfather who donated the land for the school, the lumber, and the labor to dig the foundation. So I tell those stories to youth today about the perseverance of people to ensure that their children should get an education. But to answer your question briefly, no, I did not know about Rosenwald, but I was really encouraged after learning this about that relationship between Booker T. Washington and Julius Rosenwald. Such a great success story for the country.
And I must say, this is just a personal remark, it also strongly should enhance the reputation of Booker T. Washington,
yes.
who was dissed in a lot of places yes. over the years for a lot of reasons, because people didn't understand what he was doing, I think.
Yes, so thank you.
And now I'll introduce the anticipated Clay Washington, president of the Kennard Alumni Association, whose project at the Kennard School is so broadly supported.
Good morning.
Good morning.
First, I want to thank Ann, and Ted's not here today, Ted Mack. They've been so supportive of not just this project, but all of the African-American Heritage projects throughout the state, and they've done such a great job of walking us along and holding our hands. I also want to thank the legislator here in Maryland, for keeping this funding in this grant. I know it's been tough times, but it's so necessary, and I'm glad that it stood out enough for them to make that decision. I want to thank this board, and I was here last year, and I kind of vowed to be here again this year, but for two main reasons. One, that we're doing something that will enhance the heritage and culture on the Eastern Shore. We don't see folks a lot down there sometimes, but there is such a rich culture and heritage on the Eastern Shore that we want to preserve it through this first African-American secondary school in Queen Anne's County, which was given to us as an association in 1996. By the way, we're now the owners of this building through a $1 purchase through the county. This past year, as of January the 1st. And I just want to say that all of us who are working on these projects right now have such a debt, not just to the funding that's been given to us, but also the responsibility of making sure those funds are used in a way that will honor our own heritage and the people who raised us. Quentin talked about his grandfather donating the property for that Rosenwald School. This isn't a Rosenwald school, but it was built right on the cusp of the Rosenwald era. And in 1936, this school was built, the first portion. If you can look at there, there's a back portion. The one-story portion was built in 36. The two-story portion was added in 1947. But it represents my grandfather also, who was a trustee for this original school. And the land that was bought and donated by contributions from the local community. And that's something we don't want to forget and we don't want our children to forget. One of the things that's going to be in this building will be a classroom museum to show what it was like to go to school in Queen Anne's County back in 1936 through 1966 when the schools in Queen Anne's County were integrated. I graduated from the predecessor to this school. This school was still in operation along with my high school, which is now an elementary school, on the same property. And at that point, I was able to watch this school, I shouldn't say, I was sadly watched this school deteriorate over the years. And when I moved back to the county in 2006, it became a passion of mine to see this school rebuilt. And we've been able to raise in the neighborhood of $1 million over the past 4 years for this project through our own fundraising and through grants. We still have a long way to go. Okay, but thanks to grants like this one, we're well on our way, and this school will become a place where children in our county, adults in our county, will be able to enrich their lives through seeing what was done for them to stand on the backs of. But at the same time, we'll be a cultural heritage center for the community, for adult literacy, for children's educational and cultural programs. I'm so excited about what we're going to do with this once this building is completed. And I want you guys to come join us on the Eastern Shore. There's an open invitation anytime to you, Governor, and to you, Treasurer Kopp, to come down and see what we're doing. Because you put your trust in us, and we want to be worthy of that trust. We thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's great.
If anyone isn't feeling sufficiently inspired and excited, we could keep this up for a little longer. But I thank you for your patience. And Dr. Joni Jones, who is the director of the Maryland Commission on African American History and Culture, will just say a couple of words to wrap up.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Governor. Madam Treasurer, I did want to just add, in reference to Dr. Booker T. Washington, I had the pleasure of attending the National Trust for Historic Preservation's conference in celebration of the centennial of the Rosenwald School Conference, the Rosenwald School Initiative, and it was held at Tuskegee University. And we did a great deal of conversing about the wonderful accomplishments of Dr. Washington. So he is being reassessed and celebrated.
He's a great pragmatic statesman, among other things.
Yes, indeed. But I just wanted to briefly say that in addition to the Commission's role as the subject matter experts on the African American Heritage Preservation Grant and being the lead with the review and ranking, we're also working on the stages after these wonderful projects are realized, and that's in how we're going to corral all of this wonderful information, not only the process, but the history of the different sites into something that that the state of Maryland can share and enjoy, be it virtual exhibits, traveling exhibits, publications, conferences. Just want you to know that we're thinking beyond the preservation grant as well.
Yeah, a trail, maybe. You know, you may put
that's
them all together
idea.
On a. There's so many. Well, we live in such a densely populated states, and parents are making something easy for parents to download to do that weekend trip that hits.
That's
maybe
a wonderful idea.
Too.
Well, and working with DBED and tourism.
Mm-hmm.
We've got great stuff here.
We do indeed. Thank you. Great
Thank
idea.
You. Is that it?
Can I sit my head back for 1 second?
Yes, sir.
I had the opportunity on the 23rd of July to go over to Sandy Springs Slave Museum and see it for the first time. And I will tell you, the money that you gave this young lady to enhance that museum has been incredibly well used. And I challenge each one of you to go over and see what's been done with these projects.
That's in Montgomery County? That's the...
Yes, Sandy Springs.
Yep. Is that the same... It's not in the building we just discussed.
Same
community, different building.
Yes.
Let's see. Hey, let me leave you all with this quote that I was reminded of in listening to you. A great man once wrote, "One can acquire in memory a strength not available in the present. The integrity of human presence needs and depends on this balance of time, the fecundity of the past in conversation with the possibility of the future."
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot. Okay. Anything else on the Secretary's agenda?
Is the zoo on the Secretary's agenda?
Yes. Is the zoo on the Secretary's agenda?
Sister Hutchinson.
Don Hutchinson. Good to see you, Don. Thank you for your loving and committed service to the people of our state and their zoo.
Secretary Schrader.
How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you.
How's it going?
We've had a good year. We had a bad week.
How'd the penguins weather the week?
Actually, the animals do well. You have to worry more about the people. The animals figure it out really quickly. They're African animals. They're Maryland animals. They've been through this before. And the polar bears know how to swim. So they do. But the people that you, both your guests, your workers, they're still doing their work on a day-in, day-out basis. But we weathered it very well, and as far as how did we do, we just finished the best 12-month fiscal year we've had in about 20 years. For the first time in 20 years, we've had attendance over 400,000. We generated over $1 million in new memberships, we've raised more private money than we had in many, many years. So we've had a really good year. We'll finish the year in the black, which is always a good thing. And through the support of the governor and this board and the legislature, we've been able to have a good capital improvement program that has kept pace with the environmental needs of the zoo. One of the things that people don't think very much about is that it's a third oldest zoo in the United States. We're going to replace the penguin exhibit this year for a lot of reasons. The most important reason is it's environmental. It's a facility that was built in 1960, and as a result, none of the plumbing works. In fact, for the most part, there was never any plumbing in it, we're going to replace that. So the state's been very, very supportive. So we've done very well. Thank you. And again, the state has been the major player. It is the Maryland Zoo in Baltimore.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, it is. It's the Maryland Zoo in Baltimore.
Well, and it was a zoo that could very well have gone down, Don, before you got there.
Well, thank you very much. We had a lot of challenges those first year and a half when we first moved in. It's now been 4.5 years. And over that time, we've made a lot of physical plant improvements. We just went through, by the way, our accreditation process. The AZA, American Zoological Association, was just on the campus 2 weeks ago. And they've gone through their review. We'll get a final report in September. I'll go to Phoenix to a meeting of the AZA and meet with the review board. But we are obviously very, very confident that we'll have no accreditation issues this year.
Well, when you're meeting with your fellow zoo people,
yes,
including the people from San Diego,
yes,
will you ask them about their programs for safaris at the zoo? And for, we've talked about this for maybe 20 years now,
mm-hmm.
But they do have these programs
for
overnight at the zoo, and people love them, and they identify with the zoo. And I understand all the liability issues and everything.
Right.
But somehow they've managed to.
Yeah, they've done. Certain zoos have done well with them.
I'm sure if we tried to do anything, we would do it well.
Yeah, we would. But we will explore that. We haven't talked about that. We have camps at the zoo constantly. We have several camps that are ongoing as we speak. We have a junior zoo program that's one place now with young teenagers that are participating. It's a very significant educational program. The person who runs our volunteer program, a woman by the name of Carrie Kowaleski, who's been with the zoo for about 12 years, she came out of the junior zoo program at the Maryland Zoo, then the Baltimore Zoo, back about 20 years ago. And she's an excellent, excellent employee. So it really does prepare people for work in the industry. We, at times, as you can imagine, without having to say it, I will, we envy the San Diego Zoo particularly because it's the only zoo in the country that has 350 days of perfect weather.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You really saved it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Don. Okay, Secretary's agenda. Treasurer moves approval. Seconded by the governor. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We now move over to the Department of Natural Resources Real Property. We have two requests. Approval by the board to commit program open space local share funds. One is to expand the Marley Creek Greenway and Stony Creek Park in Anne Arundel County. Total amount being reimbursed to the county, $1,100,328. And that's pretty much it.
We have some items. Lisa Ward representing the Department of Natural Resources. Good morning, Governor and Madam Treasurer. We have 7 items for your approval today.
Treasurer moves approval. Second, in all favor, signify by saying aye. Aye. All opposed, nay. The ayes have it. We move on now to Department of Budget and Management.
Governor, Madam Treasurer, good morning. There are 13 items on the Department of Budget and Management's agenda for today. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Madam Secretary, questions have arisen about item 11, which I intend to support, but I would like to hear a little something about it.
Okay. Item 11 is a request by the Department of Human Resources to extend a contract that they have for call services for 1 year to give them time to complete the procurement. Secretary Taylor Dallas is here, and other individuals have asked to speak on this contract. So we're going to start with the Secretary.
I have one set of questions for the Secretary, but then also for you, Madam Secretary,
okay.
in your role as the head of the oversight agency, and basically, let me say this. Could somebody describe where we are now and what this issue is? The Secretary, I assume.
The Secretary's here, and he can speak to where they are in this process.
Just to outline where we are.
Right now, we are we are asking for a modification to the contract to allow us up to a year to reprocure the services on the call center contract.
Yes, that is where we are.
Okay.
But to cite a little more, this was approved and appealed to the Board of Contract Appeals. Is
correct.
That not correct? And the Board of Contract Appeals did not uphold the contract. And that is why you are seeking to extend the present contract with the party that holds it now but who lost originally in the rebid, right?
Yes, the incumbent vendor was not selected in the process.
Right.
They appealed that process on the grounds that the selected vendor was not qualified, they alleged was not qualified for award. The Board of Contract Appeals ultimately concluded that the selected vendor did meet the qualifications for in the RFP, but concluded that the process that we engaged in for the RFP, we made mistakes that were fatal flaws to the procurement.
And reading the report of the Board of Contract Appeals, it occurs to me that the errors that they perceived, and I must say Mr. Dembro wrote very clearly, errors they perceived were in the evaluation of the after the procurement went out. Let me just make one point myself, which is that this is a sad story, but it does show that awards can be made in the face of a contest, and if the board overturns the award, there is a clear process for dealing with it. So it's not as though you should never approve an award in the face of the contract because nothing can be done if you do. So I would say that's a good cautionary tale for people who simply use appeal as a threat. But with this one of my understandings is that there were some changes during the evaluation process that confused things. That's at least what Mr. Dembro said. So my question now is going back. You're going to have a clearer understanding of the demands, of the number of calls. Is that so?
Yeah, once we became aware of the decision, we sat down with all the affected parts of our agency to go through the numbers of the calls and the types of services that we want. The best we can do with it, it was a setback for us, and we clearly made some mistakes in the process. The best we can do now is make sure we get the best RFP going forward, that we're contracting for the right services, and that we get the numbers straight this time.
And there'll be no need for changes. After the contract goes.
I certainly hope not.
And I've been asked, are there any changes taking place at the federal level that will impact all this and have to be worked into the new RFP anyhow?
I'm not aware of changes at the federal level. There are always changes in the rules of eligibility programs. This call center serves right. everything from child support to heating assistance.
So there has to be ongoing training, I assume.
Yes, there's changes in the rules and eligibility all the time, so folks have to be aware of those as they feel the calls.
And that fact is laid out, will be laid out clearly in the RFP.
Yes.
That was my only question of you. Madam Secretary, Madam Secretary, thank you, Mr. Secretary, sure. Madam Secretary. Is DBM doing anything? Apparently there was need for training in the evaluation process, it looks like. This is not a totally unique instance. What all are you doing?
Well, we do have training programs, and they are operated periodically throughout the year. Essentially, in this case, what the commitment that the department has made with DHR is we're going to work with them on this procurement. We're going to assist them with writing the specifications to make sure that there are no issues there. We're going to participate in all aspects of the process. And we're going to work with them on the evaluation because that is the area where the problem was. We will not be providing a procurement officer for this particular call center contract. The department will continue to do that. But, yes, we do have ongoing training, and I think this was just an instance where we had an individual who was unqualified to do it.
Is there an association, a National Association of Procurement Officers and Officials?
Yes.
Well, do they do reviews of states from time to time? Because, one of the great things about, we've talked about this, one of the great things about our procurement system is it's really good at preventing fraud or abuse. But it also is, therefore, very good at preventing procurements generally. And it also gets rid of, the flexibility that's needed in the procurement process. And I would really love to bring somebody in to kick the tires. I understand from our history the need to, have a procurement system that guards against fraud and abuse, but it really is one of the constant pebbles in our shoe. As good as we are at other things, this procurement process, can we bring some people from out of state and kick the tires? And I'm not asking. I know we can. That's a rhetorical question. I just need to do it. Peggy Watson?
It's not just kicking the time. It's looking at the laws.
Yeah, the laws and the planning. As soon as you get in, people say, but that law's here and this is here and that's the way we've always done it. Yeah. I know. Just because that's the way we've always done doesn't mean that it's being done well. And this is one area where there's been a lot of pointing to the past to justify what we're not going to change in the present. And we need to pull this apart and put it back together. And I know that this is one of those things that this administration won't see the benefit of. And there were other things we needed to take care of. But, Peggy, I really want those guys let's talk to that National Association. And I think this board would support me in having someone come in, pull this apart, and tell us how we can put it back together in a way that prevents fraud and abuse, but also allows us to make more timely and intelligent and predictable procurements that also allow people to, offer suggestions as to how they can improve the value of what we're buying from them, whether it's a service or a commodity or those sorts of things. You might start by doing a hot wash, bringing the people that oversee procurement in each of the major departments and do a hot wash of these guys of what are the biggest impediments that keep you from getting things done. And I know part of it's internal, and we have to do a better job inside the departments of seeing where these procurements are coming. So with the depletion of institutional knowledge that happens naturally over the course of any organization but was accelerated given the early out provisions and those sorts of things, we have got to start fixing this. We can't keep whistling by these incidents and pretending like this is Maryland at its best. It's not. And frankly, Madam Secretary, I think you have so much to do in your department. I'd love to find a way to get DBM out of the procurement business and altogether. You got plenty on your plate. So that's my rant. Yeah, bring them in.
So what's a hot wash?
I think a hot wash is where you just bring people in for a quick overview, even while the engine's running, and say, I think so. Somebody look up hot wash.
You're exactly right. It's a term used to describe the after-action discussions and evaluations of an agency or multiple agencies' performance. The main purpose of a hot wash session is to identify strengths and weaknesses, blah, blah, blah. But you exactly right. It said hot wash right there.
I should run for governor.
Okay. This is on DDM. Item number
item.
11. Right. Mr. Moran, do you want to speak here today, or do you want to wait until the comptroller's here?
Okay. All righty. Well, thank you. We note that you were here, and comptroller's on vacation, and we hope everybody can do a vacation sometime in the year, and we'll hear from you at a meeting when he is available. Okay. Anything else on Department of Budget Management agenda items? Treasurer moves approval. I second that motion. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to the University System of Maryland.
Morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 11 items on the agenda today. Here to answer any questions.
I'm curious about the first item. Not for conversation now, but after the fact, this question of the Hebrew orphan asylum. I'd just like to learn more about that.
Okay.
The orphan asylum, which is not now in this proposal before us, but was in the original discussion and has somehow segued. That's all I know about the Hebrew orphan asylum, but I'm just curious.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Brown and Ms. Bass are here, and they definitely know what's going on with Capitol. Would you rather just have some?
Okay, I will admit I know nothing about it. I was just curious about what this was all about.
About the Technology Center project?
Well, about the Hebrew Orphan Asylum, the building, what's going to happen with that? Is that part of your project anymore?
No, it's not a part of this project.
You want to just introduce yourself, Sabrina, to put on the record and just say that.
Yes, again, my name is Sabrina Bass. I'm the Executive Director of Capital Planning and Budgets at Coppin State University. Good morning. The Hebrew Asylum is a long-term project that the university has. It has not been funded. Our initial requirements were to stabilize the facility, and we ran out of money. And so we have not completed the stabilization, but we've done everything that we can to do that. We've spent $3.3 million in that process. And the demolition of the Lutheran Hospital site. But our plans are for the future, once we have a program approved and get capital funding, is to build a new College of Health Professions on the Lutheran site, which will include the Hebrew Asylum as part of that project. But also right now the Community Development Association, they have like a tax credit, $2.5 million in tax credits towards the Hebrew Asylum. We're working with our foundation and community association developments to try to do something with the Hebrew Asylum.
I would just like, if Sabrina, if whoever the appropriate person is, I'd just like to learn more about the Hebrew Orphan Asylum and what it is and what has been planned. It's just new to me. I'm just curious.
Okay.
Is it vacant or is it being...
Oh, it's vacant. And so it's been vacant since the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Or before, I believe, since about the 1970s.
Is this the one that's adjacent to the drug rehab?
Yes, that's correct. It's historic.
Across the big parking lot where there was always the dumping before you all finished
it? Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm somewhat familiar
with that. Yeah, it's a very historic building. He knows a little bit about it. Quite a bit. So, and the plans are for us to rehab the building eventually, but it's not in the immediate five-year governor's CIP plan.
Okay. If you could just call or Suzanne can call you.
Okay.
I'm just curious.
Okay.
Thank you.
Be glad to.
Have you looked at historic preservation dollars for it? I mean, it doesn't look like a great architectural wonder.
Well, our estimate right now is about maybe $20 million to rehab that building.
To rehab it.
Mm-hmm. Right now, the building is being supported by scaffolding that the university purchased because the building was falling in.
And so it does have some historic value, the structure?
It's been registered.
Okay, so it has been registered.
Mm-hmm. It's been registered.
I'm a little blind on that. Sometimes I'd roll by buildings and think they were nothing and want to tear them down, and then Streeper or somebody with imagination brings them back. So
yeah, we know all it's right. going to, right now the estimates in today's dollars is $20 million.
That sounds like Weinberg Foundation. Sounds like a great one.
We've made some attempts on those fronts as well, but, you know, that they expect the state to do it. And, you know, we're working towards that goal in the future.
Tell them we expect them to do it.
Well, they keep us on our toes about it.
Okay.
Make sure we don't let it fall down.
Well, if you can get something to, with some pictures and a brief to members
Absolutely.
Of the board, that'd be great. Just on the nature of the property, its history, and that.
Not a problem.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Anything else? University System of Maryland. Mm-hmm. Treasurer moves approval. Seconded by the governor. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move on now to the Department of Information Technology.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer. Elliot Schlanger, Department of Information Technology. This morning we have two items on our agenda. I'd be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Treasurer moves favorable. Seconded by the governor. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We move down to the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer. For the record, Darrell Mobley, Deputy Secretary for MDOT. MDOT is presenting 21 items today. Item 11M has been withdrawn.
Okay. Review these matters. Treasurer moves approval. Seconded by the governor. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We now move to the Department of General Services.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer. Al Collins, Secretary of Department of General Services. We have 28 items on our agenda. We have withdrawn items 10, 14, and 27. We'll be glad to answer any questions you have on any of the remaining items.
And the credit treasurer moves approval. Seconded by yours truly. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? And the ayes have it. And that concludes the department, or rather the Board of Public Works meeting for this date. Thank you all very much for tuning in.